going to kick off today's pre-show ramble by welcoming our newest partners to the fold, TwinSpires.com. JK and I are both doing expert picks for TwinSpires, which you can access by clicking on a little icon either on TwinSpires.com or through the TwinSpires app. We're going to have more news coming down the pike, including a special offer from TwinSpires, but definitely check out those expert picks. I'm doing Saratoga. JK is doing Del Mar. We've had a little bit of success so far, hoping to keep that momentum rolling. Okay, on with the show. Hello and welcome to the In the Money podcast. This is our show for Monday, August 3rd. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you from the building I'm calling the Degenerate Flophouse, basically the finished garage next to the little house on the east side. Here with you after a busy weekend of racing and happy to be joined for the second week in a row because I got many complaints about how could you have this guest on and only talk to him for half an hour? What's wrong with you? It's the ultimate hashtag host fail. So I'm giving the people what they want, and we are bringing back to the In the Money airwaves the author of Betting with an Edge, professional horse player, Mike Maloney. Mike, how are you today?
I'm good, Pete. Glad to be with you.
Well, we definitely want to get back to our what will become an occasional feature a little bit later in the show, the Mike Maloney FAQ, where we give you a chance to answer some of the questions that you get asked 62 times by random people approaching you at various horse racing events and or through the DMs of your Twitter account. But before we get to that, and then before we get to our next guest a little bit later in the show, Pat Cummings from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation will be here to talk about their latest white paper and some of the craziness going on in the paramutual world. But first, we'll want to talk about what happened on the racetrack last weekend. It was the Whitney Stakes, and I'll start with my little take. And Mike, I want to get your reaction to this. For me, this was one of the most disappointing races I've seen recently, simply because I feel like as a racing fan, I feel like we were denied the clash between Tom's D'Etat and Improbable that I think would have largely determined a horse that many might be putting on top of their lists for the Breeders' Cup Classic coming up at Keeneland this fall. Obviously, the race massively affected by the break. Tom's D'Etat sort of propping a little bit there right out of the gate, still running what was an absolutely massive race. But, of course, the plaudits go to Improbable, who got absolutely perfect trip and ends up zooming home with a 106 buyer speed figure. But do you understand what I'm saying, Mike, that I don't mean to knock Improbable, but my biggest reaction is just one of, oh, man, we didn't really learn what we needed to learn there.
No, I understand exactly, Pete. When you handicap a race and there's two really nice horses in there and you're anxious to see them go against each other and prove you right or prove you wrong, when one of them is compromised that badly at the start, it kind of spoils the party.
What did you make of Improbable's performance? We'll start with him.
Just what you said. He took care of his business. He got a good setup, but he did what a good horse is supposed to do with that setup. He won the race and won it comfortably. As far as Tom's D'Etat, I think, the race is just a throw out, but he did show a lot of courage, I thought, by running on the way he did. And the trip handicapper in me, it's a really no value in a race like this with trouble that obvious, but the trip handicapper in me is going to make me want to bet Tom's D'Etat next time and fade Improbable.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Looking at the time form adjusted race fractions and codings, no surprise at all, given just what the raw numbers were. Coded blue throughout. And interestingly, the time form ratings, as opposed to the raw speed figures, but the ratings reflect something that I said reflexively on TV, and then later was wondering if I was going to get pilloried about. But I called Tom's D'Etat best, and he did come out with the 124 on the time form ratings as opposed to the 123. I mean, maybe it's a little unfair to Improbable. Like you said, he just did what he had to do, and who knows how he would have fared had there been a serious challenge to him from Tom Stata, who obviously was doing running when the race was kind of put to bed. But I mean, what do you think of that idea? As a guy who's known for making ability figures, in ability figure terms, when you go back and look at these two, do you feel, I know you're saying from a parimutuel point of view, you feel like Tom Stata might offer a little bit more value than Improbable next out, but who was best in this year's Whitney?
I no way to really tell. From an ability figure point of view, they would end up getting about the same number from me. So it would be inconclusive there too. But you know, one thing that occurred to me that's I don't know, you know, I hadn't really thought of it before, is that Improbable he consistently has these gait issues, and they're serious gait issues. So I'm gonna be careful from this point going forward. If I like a horse or I'm heavily using a horse that's on either side of him in the gate, I'm gonna be a little cautious there, and I'm gonna try to structure my bets where I'm not totally all in on a horse that's next to him. And I know Tom Stata wasn't next to him, but I think the delay may have contributed, you know, to Tom's problems at the gate. So
that's interesting,
because he's not been that, you know, he's not been that horse in the past. So
when a horse like Improbable, who's had those issues, has now had a couple of good starts in a row, I feel like the race three back, he was acting up in the gate, but then the gate popped at the right time and it all worked out for him. And he's been a better actor lately. Do you think that's like, obviously you don't fully think that's something that's necessarily behind him, and you feel like those issues could raise their ugly head again at some point for the big horse?
With Improbable?
Yes.
Hey, I think he's proven that he has serious issues in the gate. If you watch that, you know, at Oaklawn, it was bad enough where the whip, the jock's whip went out the front of the gate, and the one of the assistant starters had to go around to the front of the gate, pick up the whip and hand it back. So, you know, you're getting jostled pretty good when you can't hold on to your whip. And if you look at the before the gate opens in the Whitney, the assistant starter that's in with Improbable does a heroic job of holding on to him.
Interesting. I missed this. This is great stuff.
He's a big, brawny assistant starter, which I'm sure that was by design. And Improbable, you know, he went up on his hind legs. He reared in the gate. And I think most sane humans would have let him go at that point. But this guy held on and brought him back down, and then Improbable's throwing his head from side to side, and the guy's just relentless and won't allow it. And, you know, and then he ends up getting a good break. He's a very talented horse. I'm sure that Baffert and his crew have worked with him, you know, over and over again, but to alleviate those gait problems, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen. So yeah, I have to factor that into my handicapping and betting from this point forward.
Very ironic that he's acting up, and then the horse who's never had problems in the gate has the crazy break that Tom Stata had. I was concerned anytime you see a break like that, especially for a horse like Tom Stata that's had physical issues, if something could have cropped up. But it sounded like after the race he was walking sound. Obviously, he ran through the lane like he was fine, and I haven't heard anything subsequently. So hopefully this great story of Tom Stata and the job that Al Stahl has done with this horse, being able to bring him into this kind of form at the age that he did. Do you think I'm correct in saying that there's not that many horsemen that would have been able to get the tune out of Tom Stata that we've seen? I really want to give appropriate praise to Al Stahl for the job he's done here.
Totally agree. I think Al has proven, you know, his past performances prove his patience. You know, he did a great job with Blaine. You know, just bringing him along, you know, no one was talking about Blaine being a great horse the first three or four races of his career. You know, he kind of exploded on the scene after a few starts. And I think that was partly true, partly because of the way that Al handled him. I think all credit to Al Stahl, the way he's handled this horse. Tom Amos told an interesting story on Fox. Maybe a lot of the listeners already heard it, but Benson, Tom Benson, the that's passed away. But was had three horses that he had bought, given to three different trainers, one to Dallas Stewart, one to Amos, and one to Al Stahl. And the other two were in the Derby, the first year that he'd gotten really serious into the horse game. And so they have a party, and Amos and Dallas Stewart are getting the kudos for having a horse in the Derby. And Al, you know, is sitting there with Tom's to Tot, you know, just as listening to everybody go on and on over the other two trainers. But I think that shows something about Al is there. A lot of trainers would have pushed very hard and probably ruined a potentially good horse in Tom's to Tot by trying to get him to do something he wasn't ready to do at that point.
Blaine is just a perfect example
for taking the right approach and the patient approach and the long-term approach and the approach that's the best for horses. And in today's, do it right now, owners all over, trainers to make it happen tomorrow. I think that's to be applauded.
No doubt. Blame is a fantastic example of that. I think, looking back to his three-year-old year, if you remember, he had a good-looking allowance win, after which I think a lot of horses would have been thinking about the Jim Dandy and or the Travers. He came and ran him in the Curlin in a much more conservative spot, but that was sort of the launching pad for that one in a lot of ways by taking it slowly. And, who knows, maybe you push a horse like Blame to try to get him to the Travers. Maybe we've never heard of him at this point, instead of having the immortal Trevor Denman call in the back of our heads. Blame. I say that as often as I can on these airwaves. And believe me, I was upset by it too at the time. But going back and listening to the call, the raw emotion in Trevor's voice, it's priceless. Let's just put it that way. Okay. Enough about this year's Whitney. We've got two other grade ones to talk about from Saratoga. Let's go back to the first one, where Vexatious wins the personal ensign, defeating the mighty champion Midnight Bisou. Going into this race, Mike, we'll play a little red board rewind here just for a second. Going into this race, how did you see things playing out?
You know, I bet a try Midnight Bisou over Vexatious, and I'm drawing a blank on the six horse. Just logical horses. And it was kind of a lazy bet. And looking back on it, when I did my recap for the day, Vexatious really, it was hard to say, oh, hey, she's going to beat Midnight Bisou. It was hard. It would have been hard for me to say that, but she was going to get a great setup. And she was great value in that race. She was, the design of the race looked like she would lay second, pressing an inferior horse and inherit the lead at some point. And on the main at Saratoga so far this meet, it's varied a little day to day, but that's not a bad trip. That's a trip that's going to move you up a little bit. So, in hindsight, I regretted it, not at least saving my money, saying that she might run out of her mind like she did when she got that advantageous trip.
I got it in my head that she just hadn't won in so long. And I figured Bisa was one. It was one of these situations that had happened a couple of years ago with Songbird, where this was a horse who I thought had shown enough signs that it was going to be some point during the year to try to take a stand against Midnight Bisou. But when I handicapped this race, I just decided it wasn't, this wasn't, yeah, she might be a little vulnerable, but this isn't the spot where she's going to lose. And so I ended up getting a little too involved, shall we say, with Midnight Bisou on the nose. Vexatious ends up winning with the 105 by her speed figure. Not without controversy, though. I'm very curious to get your take on the non-DQ decision. I felt like the video pretty clearly showed Vexatious carrying out three paths or so. And Ricardo Santana, while he never stopped riding, that's true, he wasn't able to keep a straight course. And I thought that was interesting. And for me, it made it a little bit of a 50-50 just in terms of what I thought was going to happen. Because I will say this, the stewards in New York, they have established the idea that hurting is okay as long as you don't make contact. But as I was watching that head-on replay and thinking to myself, okay, so if that's the way they're going to adjudicate it, does that mean Ricardo Santana is supposed to stay in there and take a potentially dangerous bump to get the DQ and that he actually hurt his chances of getting the race by taking a diagonal line in the stretch? It left me scratching my head, and I think it's one where reasonable people can certainly disagree, but I was curious to see if you thought that takedown was justified. Or lack of takedown.
Judging by, you know, the pattern that the stewards in New York have established, it makes sense. But I'm going to disagree a little bit with what you said there, because
please,
you said the hurting is allowed, but contact is not. Well, I think hurting is allowed and light contact is allowed.
Okay.
Because there was a little contact, I think.
Okay, that sounds right.
So now you're drawing a finer line. You know, you're saying that significant contact maybe. I don't really care how they administer these rules in New York. You know, I wish it was more uniform around the country, and all of us do. But, you know, if they want to allow the hurting and stuff as a horse player, as a bettor, I can live with it. I figure it's going to be, you know, help me 50% of the time, hurt me 50% of the time. I'm a lot more concerned about, you know, security, the wagering pools and stuff that hurt me 100% of the time. So, I'm not that worried about how they choose to do it as long as they're consistent. And they pretty much are consistent. My problem with it is I think it's gotten to the point now where it's dangerous for riders and horses. And I think we've been really lucky up to this point. I saw a non-herding issue at Indiana Downs a few days ago that was almost disastrous. And it wasn't so much riders trying to close holes. It was just, you know, something that came up in a race where a jock got in a tight, tried to squeeze through a hole and got in a tight spot, Orlando Mojica, he could have gotten killed. So I worry about that. It's not when a horse is running, 1,000 or 1,200 pound animal is running 35 miles an hour. And in order to win the race and to give your very best effort as a rider, you are required by the stewards to steer your horse into that other animal to take your best shot at winning the race, according to the way the rules are adjudicated in New York. I think that's just dangerous. I think it's wrong. So, I probably get some pushback on that, but, it's just a matter of time before something bad happens to a horse and a rider.
Do you take my point about if Santana had stayed in there and allowed there for to be more meaningful contact? That,
yeah,
I'm not saying he did anything wrong, but I feel like then they would have had to take the horse down for coming over three paths.
Yeah, I take your point, because that's the line that's drawn now. You know, it's the race later in the day, the turf race. I guess that's the Bowling Green.
Yep, we're going there next. Yep.
Yeah, just to tie that in, you know, they're, once again, I think they made the probably the right call, you know, given the standards that they're going by. but you have riders closing holes on that turf course. You have guys that are making the winning move on the outside that drift in intentionally. I see them there's a little, they take the slack out of that left rein and they encourage the horse to lug in slightly because they know they can get away with it. And they know that's going to tighten up the horses and the riders inside of them that are trying to close with them. And that's, I'm as competitive as the next person. If I'm riding up there, I'm doing the same thing, yep. Even though I know it's dangerous. Because, if you want to win, you can't give up any advantage. You can't give an advantage to another rider that he'll do that and you won't. So I put it in the hands of the stewards and I say, they need to sit down in a room or management, needs to have a conversation with them before something disastrous happens.
I want to get back to the Bowling Green DQ, but I'll ask you a tough one here first. If Vexatious and Midnight Bisou both run straight paths in the stretch in the personal ensign, who do you think wins?
I think it's a toss up. I think it's 50-50. I'm not going to call that, but I think it's unnecessary. An unnecessary drama, an unnecessary mechanics and histrionics we're all going through. I just don't like that style of stewardship.
That's great to hear your thoughts on this. Let's talk just quickly about the Bowling Green. I feel like as a race, it's not nearly as interesting as for this incident. For me, what made this one, I don't want to say a no-brainer DQ, because I know that reasonable people can disagree. But I feel like this was one where Category 2 rules make it a much clearer DQ than Category 1 rules. Because I take the point that Sadler's Joy was by Cross Border when the incident occurred. Now, I can also argue with you that Cross Border, while passed, was still finding. And the stopping of riding that had to happen by Ortiz was a factor in there. But what made it an easier call was the bump that was then given to, I guess that was Channelmaker. And, he may or may not have finished third. And this is why I hate Category 2 rules. They just make the stewards have to make all these extremely difficult decisions in this short moment that really, obviously impact us better so much. But I'm with you. I was okay with that DQ, and I did think it was much clearer in a funny way, even though I don't like Category 2. I felt like Category 2 made that DQ a bit easier. You've already said you agreed with the DQ. Was it because of the secondary bump, or did you just think it should have been a DQ in any instance?
I would say, in my opinion, watching the race, I thought Sadler's Joy was 90% to win the race if they stay apart and nobody bumps. But, that who's to know? Maybe Cross Border really digs in and surprises me. So I don't like to see graded races, or any race for that matter. I don't like to see the type of racing we have at Saratoga decided by who can survive a bump the best, or what jockey has the stones to make it look terrible on the head on and risk his life. that's not what racing's about to me. So, the only thing I'll say is for the stewards is that they're consistent. You pretty much know what's going to happen. I just don't agree with the way they do it.
That's very interesting and definitely something worthy of future exploration. I do want to talk about the other grade one at Saratoga over the weekend. That was the H. Allen Jerkins, a race I look forward to every year, and Echo Town. The figure doesn't come back super strong. It's just a 93, which tempers my enthusiasm a little bit. But I thought visually this was the kind of performance that might stamp Echo Town as a divisional player. We've seen three-year-olds step up many years and have a lot of success in the Breeders' Cup Sprint. What were your general thoughts on this year's Allen Jerkins?
I thought it was an interesting race. I thought Echo Town, what he proved to me is two things, and I pretty much knew it already. But he really proved it. That number one, he's a versatile horse, and number two, he's a fighter. Echo Town, man, do not, if I go down in the bunker, that's the dude I want with me. I mean, that horse he's a very game horse. If you watch that race, I'm not saying Echo Town had a bad trip, but he got no breaks. He's in between horses. He's a little further back than he's used to being. And it's a no doubter, he maybe only ran a 93, but he finished like he owned those horses. So, I'm still impressed with him. And I think, just his tenacity is going to serve him well going forward. And if you'll allow me, I think it's kind of interesting, the comparison between Echo Town and No Parole. Just to point out to me how much being a versatile horse is worth in racing. No Parole, very talented horse, but a one-dimensional horse. And, when he gets his setup and, you give him any breathing room on the front end, he's very hard to run down, and he's going to win a lot of races because of that. But, and he's beat Echo Town, but Echo Town is a the epitome of a versatile horse. He can go to the front, he can attend the pace, he can press a horse like No Parole, and he can close, from off the pace, take a bunch of kickback, swing out and finish, with style. So I just think it's interesting, horses with similar ability, but the difference in those horses is just the versatility.
That's a great, great point, and something that you do write about in Betting with an Edge, upgrading certain types of horses that have that ability to make their own trip, whether it's the push button types that you talk about extensively in there, or a horse like Echo Town. I mean, it's a little bit different than a push button type, right? When you're talking about a horse that can win with all three styles.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a name for that. We need to make up a name for that. But,
well, maybe for the new book.
I tell you what, it makes a difference in your gambling. Because a horse like that, he can overcome a lot. You take a versatile horse that's full of heart, and that's the kind of horse I want my money on.
That's fantastic. I love it. This is an interesting race where, watching live, I thought the pace was modest, but it's interesting looking at the way the chart plays and looking at the time form US adjusted fractions where 22.67 turns to 21.83 and gets coded red, and that 45.31 becomes 44.41 and gets coded red. It does make a lot more sense, the trouble that No Parole had on the front end. It brings Tappet to Win's trip into a different light to me too, now looking at him as the horse that made the move, not necessarily that broke the race apart, but made the move into that fast pace. I'm going to like Tappet to Win, I think, a lot coming back last time. And Shoplifted, who I initially thought, okay, Shoplifted ran, he ran great and can run even better maybe with more pace. Actually, he probably did get his setup, and maybe that's just sort of where he fits at this level. Maybe he's not beating Echo Town anytime soon. But I was curious to get your take on what you, in real time, I don't know if you've had time to sit and look at figures yet, probably not given that it's Monday morning, but just curious what you thought about the pace in this race. Was it, did you think it was as fast as Craig Mulkowski and his time form algorithm seemed to make it?
Well, I have total faith in Craig and his figs. So I haven't looked at anything yet, but if Craig says so, I'll go with that. You mentioned Shoplifted there. He kind of, I don't know how he got there, but he's becoming like the universal wise guy horse in these races. I thought he got a good setup, and I'm going to be fading him for the near future.
Yeah, I'm very guilty of that remark, as I made him one of my bets of the day over in the UK, thinking I was getting away with something, locking in 12-1, ends up going off 18-1 on the tote. Hey, did get that placing for us though. At least yeah. we may not have been exactly right, but at least the ticket cashed. At the end of the day, that's got to count for something. And speaking of Craig and his figures, I will mention that Echo Town. Not the upgrade, but the raw figure of 118. That does equate to more like a 98 on the buyer speed figure scale. So maybe Echo Town still does have room to become that Breeders' Cup sprint type horse that I was positioning him as on when I was yapping about this race without the benefit of any of this information on TV yesterday. All right, Mike, that's excellent recapping. I kept you for longer on the recapping just because I was enjoying hearing your take so much. But I do want to play this little game we played last week with the Mike Maloney FAQ, chance for you to do some one-stop shopping and answer some of the questions horse players are always asking you. Last week, we talked a little bit about bankroll management. Where do you want to go this week? What's this week's Mike Maloney frequently asked question?
Well, yeah, there's a lot to choose from, Pete. But I just got this one. We were at a little dinner party last night, and you know how we talked in the book about there are three type of people. When everyone knows you as a horse player, there are three type of people. There's the person when they learn what you do, they recoil in horror, and number two is. When they learn what you do, they kind of like nod their head a little bit, give you a kind of a weird look, and they, you know, they accept it. They don't really understand it, but
that's interesting. That kind of thing, yeah.
And then the third person, and it's almost always a male, is like, and usually they'll say it out loud, "You're the guy I've wanted to talk to my entire life." So there was one of those guys at the dinner party. So he. And so, you know, I could have six shows off this guy, but he wanted to know, he said, you know, here's my thing is I cash some tickets and I get ahead sometimes. I have trouble getting to the finish line. I give too much back, even when I have a good hit. So, I thought we might touch on that and have a conversation about something that you and I called the tuck rule in our book. And all the tuck rule means is when you get significantly ahead for the day, and by significantly ahead, I mean, if you're, and these are just loose figures, you can adjust it for yourself, but if you're a $100 a day limit guy and you get $300 ahead, or if you're a $1,000 limit a day guy and you're $3,000 ahead, my advice and what I've learned through hard knocks, I wasn't born doing this. I beat my head against the wall and, made the same mistakes over and over and over for years. And eventually, I'm not that bright, but eventually I figured a few things out. And one of them was, if I'm lucky enough to get ahead, especially early in the day, I like to tuck maybe a third of that. So if I, let's say I'm $300 ahead or better is $300 ahead and they're $100 limit, that's as much as they're going to risk for the day. I say, take your initial stake out and then take $100 profit and stick it in your back pocket. Or if you're playing on a voucher, which I always do, and when you're at the track, I'll physically go to the window and have them split it into two vouchers. And so I'll tuck that winning voucher into my wallet. And then what I have left with is my money to play with for the rest of the day. And kind of the second part of the tuck rule is I think it benefits you going forward for the rest of the day, because it clarifies how much you have to work with. When you're, you know, when you're 300 ahead and you brought 100 and you got $420 on your voucher, it's easy to make those $20 Exacta boxes and $5 try boxes and you know, the 10 cent super that turns into a $50 bet and all those kind of things that can get you off track and the kind of things that you would never do if you just had the 100 that you came with. So it clarifies for you, you know, what money you have to work with. And I think it makes it easier to look at the rest of the card and see what your opportunities are. And the way I like to do it is to identify two or three of those opportunities and say, you know, now that I've locked in a winning day, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be very aggressive with this money that I'm putting into the spots that I like best the rest of the day. The worst thing that's going to happen is I'm going to walk out of here a winner. But I'm, you know, I'm not raising the white flag and saying, you know, I'm not trying to win from this point on. Some of the best days I've ever had are in that situation where now I'll take X number of dollars and it might be a few more dollars than I would have played in that race if I were even or if I were behind. But the real difference is I'm going to play it very aggressively and I'm going to dare them to let me be right. And if I am right, I'm going to JK crush their soul.
Fantastic. What a great description. Anytime the Tuck Rule comes up, we have to give credit to the real reason the Tuck Rule is in the book, Mike. And I have to call author fail on this one from you, because I think we sent an outline of some of the early chapters to Sean Borman, who our mutual friend, and one of his extremely astute editorial comment after reading some of the original stuff we put down there is, this is good stuff, but where's the Tuck Rule? And to which my response was, Tuck Rule? What's the Tuck Rule? And that led to a subsequent conversation where we got material very much like what you just laid out there that we were able to put in the book. So props once again to Sean Borman, not just for that, but also for keying his entire day around vexatious and therefore proving himself much smarter than you or I.
Yes, absolutely. Kudos to Sean. It's nice to see the good guys score once in a while.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. And just to follow up, I do love this idea that the Tuck Rule isn't about, okay, I won, I'm now going to be conservative. It's about being very smart and doing two things. One, you are preserving some capital. But two, the idea you don't want to just get profligate and get out there and waste money spreading around in sequences that you don't have a strong opinion because you've got this money burning a hole in your pocket. But the idea that you're actually going to then be more aggressive in the spots where you do have an opinion. Because I know, Mike, and this is something that not everybody necessarily agrees with, but I know you're a believer in betting momentum. And the idea that when you're going well, those are the times to take chances. But the Tuck Rule to me means that you take those chances in the right places and maximize your chances of those scores as opposed to just spreading money around. It's something that comes up in a few different places in the book where you have this way of managing your money and constructing your tickets too, where you can be – it sounds crazy to say, but I think the way you describe the Tuck Rule – it elucidates it pretty well. You're being conservative and aggressive at the same time. Do you accept that description?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's, you know, that's really hard for people to understand, but that's the plan, the betting plan and the money management plan that I've designed for myself over the years. And it's really not a contradiction when you come to understand it, because it's trying to do is it's putting preservation of capital as the number one goal, which I think if you're going to be at the track every day, that has to be your number one goal if you're going to last. Most good horse players have good ideas. You know, most good horse players have Sean's vexation idea once in a while. And, you know, they can capitalize on that. what diffuses most good horse players is that they go through a downdraft, they go through a losing streak that just demoralizes them and crushes their bankroll and puts them in a position that when vexation comes up, they can't do anything with it. So what I try to do is to realize that my chances of winning on a given day are not always the same. The last few days of the meet at Keeneland, I have a lot better chance than I do on a random day, maybe in August. And my chances of winning in a particular race are different because, you know, I have a better opinion in some races. In some races, the crowd bets the way I see the race, therefore taking away a lot of my edge. Other races, they don't see the horse that I see, or the horse that I'm totally against, the crowd is in love with. So for those reasons, I don't think, you know, if you're going to be at the track a lot, I don't think you want to bet the same on every race. I don't think you want to bet the same every day. I think there are days that, you know, that are meant for you to fire, win or lose, and there are other days that are meant to be very careful and to protect that capital and to not get hurt on those days. I call them do no harm days.
We don't have that in the book. That's great. Do no harm days. We're getting good new material all the time. If you come on this show enough, I think there's two things that might happen. One, there'll be enough material for another book, and two, I think the listeners may lobby for JK and I to lock ourselves in a closet and just give the microphone to you, Mike. This is great stuff.
I'm lucky to get through 30 or 40 minutes, Pete. I'll leave the rest of it to the professionals. And I want to say while I'm touching on that,
please,
no one enjoys the podcast more than I do. All the different podcasts, and you know, I love being on with you because you and I know each other well enough, and we've had enough conversations that I think you make it easier for me to get my points across and to say what I really want to say. And as far as enjoying the podcast, JK, the JK Plus One, the shows that you do, the Matt Bonier stuff, it's something I look forward to, and it's rare that I go on a walk, a drive, anything without that podcast in my ear.
Oh, you're too kind. You're too kind, Mike. I appreciate it very much. We're going to have Pat Cummings here in a minute, but I will give you just one chance. If you have a quick thought about any of the, you know, you alluded before about security of the pools. There's been some high profile, interesting, shall we say, incidents that we've seen in the last few weeks. Just curious if you had anything on your mind or anything you wanted to share, or if you just want to leave all that meat on the bone for Pat here in a minute.
Well, I really appreciate Pat being on the job because I'm a fan of the Thoroughbred Ideal Foundation, and I'm full disclosure, I'm recently decided to was asked to be on a committee with them, and I accepted, and I'm excited about working with the people there. There's great people, Paul Matisse and Marshall Graham, among others, on the committee. So I'm looking forward to that and hoping that we can maybe get some things headed in the right direction. But I think, you know, everybody's got a little tired of me complaining about the security of the pools, but I continue to do, not as vociferously as I did in the past. I spent 20 years spending, you know, 10, 20, 30 hours a week trying to solve some of those problems in racing. But there comes a point when you have sat face to face through all those years, you've worked your way up to a point where you had made enough connections and possibly your opinion was respected enough where I got in front of the decision makers in racing And I explained to them that there's basically no one watching the store when it comes to the mutual pools. There's no one being paid to monitor these pools and make sure that the betting is fair, is fairly executed, and that the money that's paid out is paid out in the right amounts to the right people. And I defy the people in racing to argue with what I just said, because I know it's true. But when you have sat face to face with the decision makers and you've told them the problem and your concerns, and they acknowledge that they understand and they acknowledge that the problems exist, and they basically don't want to spend the money to update the tote system that we're still using from that was that's basically a 1970s tote system. You know, I don't know much about technology, but I don't think you have to know much about technology to know that any technology from the 1970s is not secure in today's world. So I made the statement in the book that there's over $10 billion with a B that changes hands in American racing each year. And there's no amount of money similar to that that changes hands in the world with less oversight than the money that changes hands in racing. And I think it, I think the refusal to address that hurts racing. I think it hurts purses. I know it hurts handle. I have people contact me that are non-racing people, but they're gamblers and they want, they're interested in getting involved in racing. And I think that's one of the big reasons that in pricing is one of the big reasons that they choose not to. So that, you know, that's my, bandwagon speech today, but it's just such an important thing, and you know, it needs to be addressed. But my, you know, I'm a student of past performances, and past performances tell me with the corporate ownership in racing today that all the focus is on the next quarterly report, and I don't believe that the problem is going to be addressed.
Pat and I have spoken about this, and the idea that horsemen need to take more of a leadership role, because they're really the ones for whom the future matters more than the track operators, who are, you know, I'm not judging here, but you know, they're with your corporation, you've got shareholders, and that's your thing. Like, okay, but the horsemen are partners in all this. And they're the ones with the investment in the future of the sport who, you know, hopefully there are ways, and I think TIF is hopefully leading the way with some of this, where their voice and their long-term interest for the game can be put over what's happening in the next quarterly stock market report. And I think your cynicism is well-earned in terms of being a student of past performances on these issues, Mike, but I'm also very glad there are people like you willing to speak out even at this point, and people like Craig Burnick and Pat fighting the good fight, trying to advocate for reforms in these matters. So
yes, all credit to Craig Burnick and Pat Cummins for their efforts, because it's no fun going up against you know, the racetrack leadership trying to convince them to spend money to do the right thing. I've been there, and so I really appreciate Craig and Pat's efforts.
All right, Mike, I'm going to let you get out of here, but thank you so much for your time today.
Enjoyed it, Pete. We'll do it again soon.
I'd like to take this opportunity between guests to let folks know about a couple of fun events coming up with our friends at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Live at the Brentwood this week, Wednesday night. That's August 5th, coming right up. It's probably later today, depending on when you're listening to the show. And if you make a donation to the TRF, you can attend this very exclusive gathering. Going to be talking to different listeners even while sitting there outside, weather permitting, on the picnic benches in front of the Brentwood. The Brentwood's open for business. They're doing well. They do have some rooms left for the summer. You might want to check that out as well. But come join us for this show on Wednesday. I'm just saying after the races, 6 o'clock, there will be cocktails. We will order pizza, and you might just get to talk on these In the Money airwaves as well. Go to trfinc.org/players for details about that. And while you're there, check out the news about the TRF barbecue next week. That's on Tuesday, the 11th. Very limited spaces available if you want to get a meal there. Check out all the details over at trfinc.org/players. Okay, I told you he was dropping by. Now he is here. He is the executive director of the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation and an advocate for horse players. He is my friend, Pat Cummings. Pat, how are you today?
Peter Thomas, happy August. Last time I talked to you, I know I said happy July, but happy August, and thank you. Yes, doing well.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. You have a new paper out that you are the author of. I know it's a collaborative effort, the work that you do at the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation with your board and various other resources that you have. The paper is called Racing Not Only for the Elite, but I think we should start, rather than talking about the guts of the paper, with a little bit of current events, because I know a lot of horse players have seen these recent stories about the jackpot hits at Pleasanton and Del Mar and some unusual information about them. I've been one of the many people who's been on record being an opponent of these jackpot wagers because in my hypothesis and others' hypothesis, I don't want to make it sound like this is me as a one-man band, but this idea that these are wagers that are essentially benefits for the highest level wagering computer assisted customers marketed to and paid for on the backs of the rank and file horse players whose bankrolls suffer as a result, causing the entire industry to suffer as a result. And I feel like in these recent pick six examples, we maybe have more than just a guy with his tinfoil hat howling at the moon in me, and maybe some hard data to back up these assertions that I've been making. Let's start off with the basics. What can you tell the listeners about what happened with these Pleasanton and Del Mar pick six bets?
Well, let's work with just one assumption to get everybody on the same page, or one point, and that is this is an incredibly complex situation. Okay, this is not easily explained. I'll get to the Pleasanton and the Del Mar thing, but overall, sure, what we're talking about is really it is incredibly complex. There are many facets, macro, micro focuses and elements and different players. And it does remind me of the old line from Stuart Scott on SportsCenter years ago: don't hate the player, hate the game. Hate the game because there are elements of this game and its organization that have led to this, right? So this is actually far more complex than it seems at face value. So
I love that point. And just to reiterate, yeah, it's very easy, and you'll see other howling at the moon on Twitter about, oh, these players, look what these guys are doing, referring to the high volume customers themselves. And you know, that, again, it's not, I'm so glad you pointed it out, because I don't mean to pillory them or say that they're doing anything wrong. It's something much more systemic and holistic that needs to be tackled. So I have to continue my
point. So the more recent examples that have kind of cropped up are two different pick sixes. They were a week apart. One was on Sunday, July 19th at Pleasanton, part of the California Fair circuit. And then the other was at Del Mar on Sunday, the 26th. Of July. And both are jackpot pick sixes, but they're both different. Okay. So the Pleasanton jackpot pick six is a 20 cent minimum. A portion every day goes towards that jackpot. Whereas the Del Mar pick six is a $2 pick six with a very small portion that goes towards the jackpot. So that jackpot builds much slower at Del Mar and can grow much faster at Pleasanton and to a higher number because it is presumably tougher to hit. So these jackpot bets have all evolved. Frankly, I mean, it might feel like they're new, but these have really been around for more than a decade. They started at Beulah Park, which doesn't even exist anymore, of course. Although they've been around for a long time, but they still had that plaque at Beulah that called it the Saratoga of the Midwest. And let me tell you, I have never seen a bigger reach cast into bronze as that plaque that I saw at Buell in maybe 05 or 06. But anyway, I digress. The Pleasanton pick six that was paid out was a 40-cent ticket. Now, it's a 20-cent minimum. And I think there's a lot of players, among them the more recreational set, but who have felt that there's been a bit ingrained in them that you, if you have two 20-cent tickets of the same combination, you don't have a unique ticket. That's not exactly the case. It depends on the rules of each racetrack, each association. Within the state of California itself, different tracks can apply different rules to the same bet. And of course, across the country, that spreads. That is different from track to track, state to state, and certainly to players, you know, all across North America. So it got hit on a 40-cent ticket, but it was reported that the player had put in more than, I think it was close to $4,700 in that ballpark, under $5,000 in that play. And the total pool that they pulled down, because they were the quote-unquote only ticket, they were the unique ticket, a single serial number that was tied to that bet, went to a player at Elite Turf Club, and that they pulled down altogether about $153,000. Their bet... Yeah. Go ahead.
Let me just interrupt you for a second, Pat. For those that might not know what Elite Turf Club is, maybe this would be a good time to fill them in.
Sure. In the purposes of our paper, we define Elite Turf Club as one of several high-volume betting shops, or HVBs. These groups are different than what we would call more retail ADWs. They cater to a very select, high-end client, and they bet tremendous amounts of money, more than we could even fathom. A 2012 Blood Horse article reported that Elite Turf Club alone was responsible for 10% of handle in North America that year. Okay. In the U.S. that year alone.
That's insane. I mean, we're talking
more than $1 billion.
And when you say a small group of people at one point, I know that I'm sure it's grown since the 11 responsible for the tremendous amount of handle in the first time reporting. But whatever it is, we're that's a crazy number when you're talking about a few dozen individuals at this point. Or maybe
And actually the California Horse Racing Board filings earlier this year that we've investigated listed, there's 12 different Elite Turf Clubs, Elite Turf Club 1 through 12, which to us at least suggests that there's just currently 12 accounts at Elite All.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense. But anyway, sorry to
no, there are sorry other to groups, right? There are other groups like this, and these groups will bet tremendous amounts of money. And what's important to know is it doesn't take $100 million to bet $100 million. Right. If you're betting, you know, you might need $5 or $10 million to churn $100 million by winning and getting rebates. And these are racing's highest rebated customers. So if the blended takeout across win bets and exactas and tries and supers ends up being about 20%, these guys never pay 20%. Okay. These guys may pay, just in pure raw takeout, you know, form in terms of what their rebate is, they're probably getting close to 10% rebates or higher overall. Okay, so they're probably paying at least 50% less than the published takeout or what the average player is going to play. And they do so because they get a volume discount, right? There are reasons to want these players in the pool. There's quite a number of them, and we estimate that these types of entities, the HVBs, are betting what we think is between 30 and 35% of all American handle. Now, that is very difficult to nail down, but we have some expert consultants who suggest that that is a fair number. Some say it's a little high. Others would suggest, you know, if it's not there right now, it's getting there. Right, we're getting to that point. And it's also worth noting that 16 years ago, these guys represented about 8%, 7 to 8% of all play. We think it's about four times greater than that now.
And that relationship, that numerical relationship actually leads to, and I've gotten you way off the Pleasanton Del Mar topic, and I apologize, but I do think the background's going to help a lot of listeners follow the story. What scares me about that number is, look, when you look at the overall handle and you look at how much theirs has grown, well, this is a zero-sum game. And that means that other handle, presumably what you refer to in the paper as recreational handle, has dropped kind of a staggering amount, yeah. Which has to send some – if that doesn't ring alarm bells for folks in the industry, I don't know what would – I know you codified – quantified, I should say, the number specifically as what you think – how far down you think the recreational handle has gone in that time. What was your hypothesis? Maybe it's stronger than a hypothesis, your findings in that for that question.
If you make – all you really need to do is make one estimate, and that is what percentage of current wagering is coming from the high-volume betting shop players now. And we think that number is, like I said, 30 to 35%. So if you just took half of that and just said one-third of all American play is coming from high-volume betting shops, that would suggest – purely by adjusting for inflation based on the numbers that we know from 2004 and all other things really being very confirmed facts. That means that non-high volume play has declined 63% in about 16 years.
That's not good.
And this has monumental macro and microeconomic impacts. The micro being to individual players, whether you are a recreational player, a real kind of weekend warrior, or even the lower level computer assisted wagering players who are out there. And it has macro effects on the economy of racing, the purse structure, how purses are, how the contributions from wagering purses or from wagering get to purses.
That's a great point.
You know, retail customers, recreational customers are the most valuable customer to racing in relative terms, right? Each recreational customer's wager is more meaningful, but they are a reduced number. On the other hand, in absolute terms, the high-volume betting players are contributing as a segment a tremendous amount of money, right? They are very valuable. That if they were to just leave and you cut them off entirely, that hurts if you lose those players. So it's very difficult to get to a world where you can just cut them off. They impact the numbers a lot. In the paper, Pete, and this will get us back to the Del Mar point, we identified high-volume betting shop players and tried to analogize who they are. We say that they're profit maximization machines. Okay, these are customers who don't bet big, just, you know, they're not whales. Okay, these guys aren't flashing around big money in Vegas just because. They bet big because the math tells them to bet big. Okay, they are driven by their programs. They are driven by quant data. This is Wall Street intersecting with horse racing. And we said these are racing's equivalent of the Flash Boys. And racing is a sport and an industry that is replete with inefficient market behavior. I think the horse sales are the greatest example of one of the most inefficient markets you will ever find. Racing has a bunch of them. These guys are the opposite of that. Okay, these guys don't lose. They get the absolute best deal that they can for themselves, and it dictates how much they play. So we can't blame them for that. We just have to recognize what they are. And how do you, as an ordinary player, as a recreational player, we define recreational play as under $100,000 a year, we identify these, it becomes a profit maximization machine when there is a player betting 8,700 combinations, straight straight $2 pick sixes, 8,700 of them in a pick six, all singles, and spending $29,000, or essentially 15% of the total pool. That is not a weekend warrior. It's not a recreational play. And as Marshall Graham on Twitter, one of our TIF board members, a friend of the show and a friend to many, said, computer-assisted wagering bettors who work through normal ADWs are limited to uploading 3 bets per second. If one of those players was trying to get 8,700 bets in, it would take them, you know, like 46 minutes to do it. So the playing field is very unequal. And when Del Mar comes out and said, here's the structure, et cetera, even though there is no official confirmation that the player came from Elite or any other high-volume betting shop, the behavior and the way in which the bets were entered is highly suggestive of that.
It really scares me, the Del Mar example. We've always said on the show one of the reasons where, and I don't think we're necessarily wrong about that, but one of the reasons we're particularly against 20-cent minimums is the ability for these big guys to construct these big groups, I guess you could say, to construct these type of tickets where you can essentially use Dutch principles, eliminate a certain portion of the field to account for your effective takeout, and then just pour liquidity in, bet in an efficient way. I get the idea, you know, the 20-cent minimum makes that a lot easier. To see them doing it with a $2 minimum is truly terrifying. And here's the thing, I don't know if you talked to anybody about when you were doing the research for the paper, but what really terrifies me even more is to see the percentage of the pool being occupied by these bets. It is, for me, and you know, I'm no expert. I would certainly trust what Marshall Graham or Maury Wolf, proper economists, have to say about this. But for me, to see an entity making wagers that represent that much of the pool, it seems crazy in a way that suggests to me that there is an edge that goes beyond just being able to upload bets at a much faster speed per second, that there's whatever it is, there's something else going on here, whether it's some sort of unheard of rebate that goes beyond even what you were speculating, Pat, or, you know, it's been speculated, I don't know any truth to this, but the ability to potentially to look in pools and see what combinations are covered, or perhaps, you know, you mentioned in the paper and you just mentioned on the show before, Flash Boys, the idea of the power of being able to go last in these markets, and or it's not a direct analogy with Flash Boys, but I think it works well enough. There's something else, it seems to me, that's going on here that makes this, the market behavior for people that we know are winners, it's not somebody make overbetting a pot. There's a everything they do for a reason. What do you think the reason is? First of all, am I right that that these wagers seem like they're overbetting the pot? And then secondarily, what kind of an edge do we think these players have?
The first point, that first question, we put in the paper a reference to a couple things. One is the pick fives at Saratoga that we've noticed so far this meet, and participation in those. And then we actually had a plethora of examples to choose from. Fawner earlier in the year, the pick five with mandatory payouts. The Charlestown pick six recently was one. But we chose a Gulfstream Rainbow Six example, which is mandatory payout from May. And we really evolved that example. And what we see is that if you were to plot every update of the pool, every time money is coming into the pool, and you could do this through various ADWs, you can easily see it. If you plot that and you just chart it over time, every update that comes in is an influx of new money, and you just keep track of all those numbers. Some very clear patterns start to emerge, and that most updates over a particular, you know, period in the time leading up to the race, you will see this money. You know, the pattern will be clear, such as this. So May 9th, 2020, Gulfstream Park. There were the final updates of 25 pool updates before the race started. There might be, in a normal sequence, maybe 60, 55 pool updates. The final 25 is what we're talking about. The average of 13 of the final 25 pool updates was $31,000. A total amount of $405,000 went in for roughly half of the final 25 pool updates, new money coming in. The other 11 updates saw a total of $5.2 million at an average of $470,000 per click into the pool, per update. So the average of the 11 of the last 25 updates was larger than the entire amount of the other 13 updates combined. So what can one infer from this? The smaller updates are representative of what we'll call just normal ADW play right now, because that's really the only way that, that people are accessing the pools. The high-volume betting shops, however, have direct access to dump their bets directly in, right? They don't have to go through a normal ADW channel. Well, if $5.2 million of a $10.6 million total pool is representative of the these high-volume betting shop players, that's 49% of the entire pool on mandatory jackpot payout day. And we've got a couple of those coming up in the next few days, and of course, we'll be watching them, and we'll see what happens. On a smaller level, it's been happening at Saratoga. In the pick five, we noticed, for example, that there was early pick five last week, Wednesday, July 29th. There were 31 updates in the final 5 minutes. The average of 26 of the final 31 updates was just under $6,000. But for the other five of 31, it was just over $60,000, 10 times more than the average of the 26 other updates. So in the last three plunges were $56,000, $27,000, and $79,000. The three cycle updates before that were $3,500, $4,800, and $4,000. These are different customers.
If you had to guess, back to that original question, and I know this may be taking you out of your comfort zone because you're so data-based, and I'm asking you to just make a fairly blind hypothesis, but what do you think the incentive is to bet at these levels? Is there some sort of rebating that goes on beyond what we were talking about before? Do you think there could be a technological advantage beyond the Marshall Graham quote from the paper?
I do not believe there is a technological advantage that they have gained access to that is in some way revealing how other customers are betting, right? There's no evidence of it. Secondly, why would there ever be a carryover if a group of customers had access to know how other customers were betting exactly, right? There would never be a carryover if that was the point. Now, the public's rising belief that this is happening is a byproduct of really a lack of transparency, a lack of addressing this, and allowing this to fester over time. And I frankly commiserate with the players, myself included, who have these concerns. But I don't believe that they have done that. These are the smartest players in the market, right? They're betting purely based on the math. And I think there is every reason to believe that these high-volume betting shop players have modeled how the recreational and middle markets are going to bet these bets, and they know and will try to take advantage of that with their own play. It is in
makes
their
sense.
Play.
I mean, that makes sense. That's been going on for a very long time. I mean, I can
remember.
And
there's nothing illegal about it, right?
No,
right? Yeah, we're not suggesting that.
Yeah, as far back as Six Secrets of Successful Bettors, I remember talking to Randy Gallo, actually, about how they were doing all kinds of fun math games with the pick six of figuring out what courses, what different combinations were supposed to pay, right? So in the pick six, trying to figure out what was going to pay what in terms of combinations, and then just like eliminating the swaths of combinations that were paying like below a certain amount. I'm oversimplifying, but like that idea of modeling what it should pay and trying to find out where in that universe the extra value is, that does seem like something they're more than capable of doing. But okay, even if there isn't some other advantage in terms of even beyond the normal takeout being granted, in a way, as a horse player, it makes it more terrifying to me that their algorithm and informational edge is so good that you can make a bet on a non-mandatory payout day that's 15% of the pool or whatever and actually have equity on that. Like in a way, that's more scary to me as a horse player.
So it exacerbates the financial disadvantage that recreational and middle and upper market players are at, right? Not all customers have equal access to put in their information. When we see a horse's odds drop from 15 to 1 to 8 to 1 in the last click, there is one customer who knows that's coming, and that's the person that's putting that bet in through their high-volume betting shop, okay? The other customers don't. They are disadvantaged financially as a result of that. It is because there is a natural there is a technological disadvantage which has enfranchised the high volume betting shops to encourage participation. And that's something that the industry has to come to terms with, right? We are giving an advantage to a certain customer over another. And much more so than the middle and higher volume computer wagers that are not at the level of the high volume betting shops. And that has deleterious effects on different customers in different ways. So think of it this way. If there is a high volume betting shop who's betting $500 million, okay, and the total payout on the $500 million is $496 million, they're looking like they have a small loss on the year. But if they're getting a 10% rebate on average, their play was $500 million. Now they're getting an extra $50 million on top of that. Suddenly they went from being down to being up like more than 9% overall. That's substantial.
And so it has knock-on effects. Yeah, that correct. Has massive knock-on effects in the market where when you're turning, you know, it's really all a game about betting horses at the right price, right? And so when you're taking, because of that economic advantage you have, you're taking what would have been a winning price for somebody else and turning it into a losing price. I can only imagine. You say deleterious, that may be a polite word for what it's doing. Yes.
this is an absolute crusher for ordinary players. And the example we use is say if a group of players through TVG in the first quarter of 2020, TVG players bet about $350 million. If the return to those players was $175 million, that is in a way an effective takeout of 50%.
No doubt. Right. That's the right way to look at it. And while I understand the idea and don't object at all to the idea, I mean, look, I think we all wish we lived in a world where instead of having rebates as I'm talking about a theoretical world, if we were starting over, rather than having rebates, you'd just have a low takeout for everybody and you'd let the market do its thing. At this point,
bring it back though, Pete, to really what our ask is in this paper, because I think it puts it in a nice little bow and package.
Let's do it.
This is a problem. It is increasing in magnitude as seemingly the tracks are doing more and more deals and maybe making these deals more advantageous to these customers. That advantage, some of it is earned, okay? But that which isn't earned is actually harming the most valuable customers to the sustainability of horse racing, right? We said that many people have left horse racing over time. And those of us who are left, who are yelling, are doing so for a reason, right? Things have not gone well in our sport. And in 2004, there was a report called it was commissioned by a group under the NTRA that was called the Wagering Systems Task Force. And it's a fantastic report. We link to it in our own story. And everyone can get this paper at racingthinktank.com. In it, it outlined the threat that this poses to the long-term future of racing in America. It frankly doesn't touch on slot machines and how they impact purses and whatnot. But it's a very, very enlightening paper that the industry paid for. And most of the recommendations within it said, if you don't get a hold of this and you let this continue to grow, it will create very serious long-term problems. So you need to find a way to manage it. Our call to action in this paper is based off of the ignorance that the racing industry applied to that 2004 paper and calls upon the stakeholder group within our business who has contract approval privileges to approve deals with wagering entities. And that's the horsemen. And that's kind of unusual that the average bettor doesn't consider the horseman for anything other than a vehicle to train a horse, own a horse, and raise a horse. But at the end of the day, they have the say. They have to agree based on federal law, the Interstate Horse Racing Act of 1978. They have a say in approving when bets are offered for customers across state lines. And so our call to action here is not one that is full of solutions and we offer a plethora of recommendations. We don't. We say the horsemen need to recognize this as a problem. Come to the table, understand what the issues are, investigate, and more importantly, ask questions of the racetracks, understand the customers better, and then we can begin to work on rectifying the marketplace to operate in a more sustainable fashion for all parties. We don't want to entirely, it can certainly be discussed about eliminating the high volume betting players altogether. I think that would be very challenging. But it's putting the cart before the horse to suggest a raft of recommendations as to how to solve this when the people who actually have some really pretty strong power in the equation aren't even really cognizant of the fact that there's a problem.
I think that's very well put, and the people who hold the power need to understand the overall economic picture, because you see things in the paper of, oh, but handle's great. Look at these handle numbers. And it's like, does not reflect revenue. You know,
at handle straight up, right? Straight up numbers of handle in the U.S. in the last 16 years. Raw figures, they're down 27%. Adjusted for inflation, it's 49% decline. But if you extract the quality of that handle, what was high volume betting shop play versus what it is now, that's where we come up with the figure that says what it was is 8%. We estimate it to be 33% roughly now. And what does that do? Again, from an inflation-adjusted standpoint, we suggest that it is non-high-volume betting shop play is down 63%. And there are just a tremendous number of knock-on effects. Now, I will point you to this, Pete, and maybe we'll talk about it at some point in the future. But the Wagering Systems Task Force report from 2004 offered several examples to show what happens when racetracks did limit certain high volume players. And there were two examples of it, one at Woodbine, one at Oaklawn. And the result seemed to indicate that by shutting them out, you increased the churn. The churn effect is real. You increase the churn amongst the higher takeout players, and it increased commissions to tracks and therefore horsemen.
It's unbelievable. This was in 2004.
And it's all just laid out there, Pete. And that's the thing that we're just hair pulling here in the TIF headquarters of what was laid out, what the industry paid for, and basically has ignored.
I'm very glad you linked to that whole paper, but I'll tell you what I know exists. And I think I might know the man who has it. And he was on the show earlier today. There was also like a little glossy booklet with like summarizing the recommendations that the NTRA put out that I swear, if I know Mike well enough, you know, old antiques dealer, bit of a pack rat, he's got that thing in a box somewhere. Maybe we can get him, actually more realistically, maybe we can get Laura, his wife, to scan it and share that with people. Because I do, as much as I want everybody to go read the paper, as I recall, it was a bit dense. And the summarized recommendations was very nicely done.
So trust me, people think our paper is dense. The Wagering Systems Task Force report is dense. There is an executive summary you can read, but I'll be honest, I'd read it before. It doesn't come close to the real value of the full report.
It's worth reading, but we'll help our listeners out of this TLDR world. But just again, to make that analogy about handle numbers, I mean, you make a great point about figure out what's going on, the direction, the trend, by just what the raw numbers are. But now think about this. That number is it would be as if a business was bragging about what it was selling at the retail level when it's doing 35% of its business, really much more than that, because there's a whole level of rebate customers who aren't even reflected in that 35% you were talking about, Pat. Is doing whatever, 50% of its business wholesale, but they're telling you what the retail cost of those wholesale items is. That's what trying to trumpet success via handle is to me. Am I being too harsh in that analogy?
No, not at all. There can be a lot of comparisons made, Pete, but realistically, there's very little, I think, that compares in kind of economic markets, quite like what we're seeing here.
I want to button up with two things. You've talked about the call to action to horsemen and how important that is. We'll get back to exactly what that means and what needs to be done. But before that, we do have horsemen listeners, but we have an overwhelming number of horse player listeners. Obviously, that's who we are. Is there anything we can do in terms of voting with our dollars or making our voice heard?
Sound out, right? Don't be silent. But here's the thing I think that is important. Don't hate either, right? We need all players, okay? Horse racing is in a position that is incredibly precarious. And something we say in this paper is that, it might be part of the reason why we might be hearing more of this and more frustrations is because what 15 years ago may have resided on a couple of internet message boards is now in kind of more of a public social media sphere where it's much easier for us to see and sort through feedback on a fairly level playing field. But I think part of the reason we're also hearing it is because so much of the recreational player market has actually concentrated, right? There are far fewer of us around. And those who are around care. They care a lot. And we, I think, as a sport, may have sacrificed our most loyal and passionate customers by focusing on maybe a very select few. And that's a very dangerous path to continue down, because your loyal players are the ones who are going to fight. And these are the ones who have stuck through thick and thin with horse racing when the game has given players many reasons to leave over the years. So we need people to be attentive to these things, to call out injustice, to call out situations where the tracks may not be looking out for the best interests of the sport and the horsemen. And very strangely, in the game of kind of or the race of horse players versus racetracks, I think the tracks have won that. But in the battle between horsemen and racetracks, the verdict is still out. Horsemen, horse players, and horse people are far more aligned in their interest than they realize at all.
It's a good point.
And the closer, you have to respect them, there needs to be an increased mutual respect. But they actually have a power that the horse players don't. When horse players say, "Who fights for us?" A lot of times people say there isn't really anybody. I mean, I get those emails sometimes and say, "Oh, thanks for saying this. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it." But realistically, the people who do fight are the horse people, the horsemen's groups, the HPPAs, the THAs. Have they done a good job of it? I think it's, that's a questionable you know, performance record. Can they do a much better job? I think so. And we're trying to encourage them to.
What does that better job look like? I guess that's what it's getting down to. Like, I give you the magic wand. What, obviously, the recreational player and the new player, to me, these are the future annuities to the sport. People who could get in and, you know, even if you're betting, it doesn't matter how much you're betting, but if you're betting it every year, you're becoming an annuity to the sport. Think of an ecosystem with, you know, all sharks and nothing else to eat. Eventually all the sharks die and then you got nothing. Like, we need to cultivate a healthy ecosystem. There's no doubt about that. But how do we do it? Is this about lower takeout for everybody on some level? Is this about the tote system that Mike was talking about, the astonishing idea that this is still basically patched over 1970s technology that we're not, you know, able to all compete on a level playing field as far as that goes? Like, what the horsemen have been tasked with trying to represent the horse players and save the business. What is it we're really asking them to do?
We've posed four questions that horsemen and horsemen's representatives groups need to ask racetracks in these processes for approving contracts. Where's the handle coming from? What are the effective takeout rates for horse players from these different sources? What are the tracks doing to attract retail, recreational, middle market play, and then retain them? And are some groups, or how are these groups being treated differently? What is the preferred access that they're getting? Are we advantaging one set of customers over another? Horse people organizations need to start caring more about horse players. And they don't have this naturally within their groups and organizations now. They need to. This is a process. It has to start. And we think the future sustainability of the business is at risk if they don't start asking these questions. So we put those questions out there. They have to start taking their contract approval processes to a greater level. A greater level of understanding. And I assure you, Pete, we don't make these claims without having had conversations with various horsemen's groups over the past few months, on and off, different states, different tracks, where we have come to the belief that they don't really have a good handle on their own numbers.
Do they seem receptive, though? I mean, is it adversarial, these conversations, or are they accepting the work that you're doing as something that's trying to help them, too?
No one likes to be told they haven't done a good job, right? And when you combine that with the fact that horse racing is full of losers, that 90% of customers walk away from a day at the races having lost, as opposed to team sports where it's a 50-50 proposition most of the time, the next win is typically never too far away. We know that for horsemen, sometimes it could be a very long time. Right. Even the best of them go through slumps. Chad Brown's had a pretty rough Saratoga. I'm sure, you know, the past couple of weeks haven't been as enjoyable as some other times for him. That kind of natural, you know, the frequent loser effect that racing has for everybody can grate on people, I think, after a while. And then to be told that you haven't done and kind of stood up for the horsemen's groups, I think that gets a little frustrating. So there are opportunities to make a change. And we think that if these questions are asked, there will be some improvement.
I mentioned
we're happy
about,
to help along the way.
Well, that's right. I mean, you put your money where your mouth is, that's for sure. You and Craig Burnick and everybody at TIF are not just talking. You're here to and not just espousing your point of view. You're also here to listen and try to incorporate the best ideas that are going to help move the industry in a forward direction. But I mentioned Update Horsemen, you know, hopefully being able to advocate for some change in terms of takeouts, in terms of technology updates. Is there anything else? Is there another area besides pricing and technology? Mike mentioned wagering security. Proper oversight of money. I mean, I suppose that would be another one, but I'm just curious if there's any other areas I'm missing.
Definitely fixed odds development. You know, there is a segment of what we would call middle and upper market play that is highly critical of the development of fixed odds for betting on horse racing. And they are critical because they want retail recreational play in their pools, right? So they don't want competition to come and take recreational money away from tote pools. And so they look down on fixed odds play. And they also think that they won't be able to get on like they can right now in the tote pools with really big bets. It is a very self-serving position for those sorts of players to be making those arguments. But bettors are self-interested. So I don't begrudge them for hating the fact that fixed odds development could take recreational play out of the tote pools. That is a natural byproduct. What we think,
I don't think it's the long-term byproduct, though. I think long-term, it absolutely helps the parimutuel handle by creating more winning players and keeping more people in the game. And also the idea of, I don't think in this culture where we have such a pick four, pick five culture, I don't think people are going to be shifting their action 100% to fixed odds. I think what's going to happen is you're going to see people giving and taking and mixing and matching. But the most important thing I think fixed odds will do is just create a better culture of horse player and more of a winning culture. And I think that's obviously going to just get more money involved in the game. So I think that's a, some may have that view, but it's very short-sighted.
Competition makes your business work harder, but it's hard work, right? You know, you have to work harder to maintain your business. We think the end beneficiary of that hard work are all the customers, right, at all levels of the value chain. But could there be some temporary shifts as a result of it? And yeah, absolutely, right? There are short-term, intermediate, long-term effects to all of these sorts of decisions, and they're going to affect the market differently. But we believe that competition helps the market. It doesn't stifle it.
We talk all the time, mostly not on the air, mostly in private meetings, about co-opetition and the idea that rather than fighting over slices of a diminishing pie, the focus should be on making the pie bigger. And that's what that's what Pat's talking about. And it's a great message to close this edition of the show on. The paper is called Racing Not Only for the Elite. It can be found at racingideas.com. Pat, remind folks where they can find you on Twitter.
Pat Cummings, TIF, at Racing Ideas. And any feedback on the paper anyone wants to share, you can reach out to us on the social or send an email, thoroughbredideafoundation@gmail.com. Very simple.
Good stuff. All right, Pat, I want to thank you. We'll thank Mike Maloney one more time. We'll thank JK in absentia. We'll thank our sponsors and partners, including the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, TwinSpires.com. Very cool to have them in the lineup as well. 10 Strike Racing, Woodbine, all the places that have been supporting us throughout the since we started this company, whatever it was, a little bit more than 18 months ago. But most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do, for all of your feedback. Can't appreciate you enough. Hopefully I'll get to see you at one of our safe, socially distanced events soon. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!